WS2N.
Yeah, Paul recognized. I think you're saying you've got a V-shaped groove. The projectile only rides at the top of the V. It doesn't get a chance to go all the way down. Over to you, John, and then pass it over to Paul. You got it, John.
That basically describes it, Dick. So we have a nice, even edge contact on both sides of the groove. I mean, this is a real Rube Goldberg crude, but I was thinking about trying to control the upper part of it because I was afraid if this thing were to flip or go crazy, I have no way of controlling it. So that was my only reason for using that. But we haven't gotten to that point yet. Paul, over to you, sir.
Okay, John. Yeah, I just had one question. Yeah, you're doing it outside, you got to be losing some of these. I call them bullets. You know, projectiles. You know, where are you getting them from? Is this like aluminum tubing that you just, you know, you cut a million pieces and you have a supply of them? You know, you got to be losing some of these, like the ones that you shot into the air. And the other comment I wanted to make is, oh, probably at least 30 years ago, I remember seeing a show, and they wanted to develop a system to get, you know, once they got to the moon, they were going to mine the moon, and you know, they thought of this idea of having some kind of magnetic guns attached to the moon's surface, and they would fire, you know, consistently fire these things. It was like a conveyor belt, and the material would be shot off so fast like that, it would, you know, no atmosphere and everything, and it would actually go into orbit around the moon, and then they would collect it up there, and they would bring it back to Earth. You know, they wanted to bring back tritium and all these things, all these products. That's what this sounds like, an extension of that, you know. I don't know if they ever worked out the detail. You could always sell this one to NASA. John, back to you.
KC2WGP. Yeah, Paul, you got the idea. Basically, yeah, that's what they were going to do. And I think the one that they were going to shoot these products with was like a mile long or something like that. But as far as the projectiles, went to Home Depot and bought aluminum rod, different diameters, but the quarter inch seemed to work out the best. And what we did was cut them to lengths, different lengths. But before we cut them, we stuck them in what is basically a pencil sharpener, but it's made for drill bits. It just stuck it in there. It has a little grinder in there, and it breaks a 60-degree angle, so it makes a nice little nose on the front. Then we took a drill press and some V-vices and tried to drill out the center to lighten them a little bit, but still have enough to give us our magnetic structure. So we're trying all different things. It's really a beautiful little project, a lot of fun. And, yeah, we lost quite a few of them. Between ricochets, and except aluminum doesn't ricochet like steel. It doesn't go as far, but it does get damaged very easily. But as I mentioned before, we were trying to shoot them in the air to see if we could follow them, painting them black and stuff. But when they left the rail, you couldn't follow them with your eye. No way. I thought we could do it like an arrow, but it didn't work.
When your aluminum projectile hits a brick, I presume the nose of it gets blunted really crazy, and it becomes almost a pancake against the brick. Is that approximately what happens, John?
Absolutely, Dick. They mushroom right over like you would mushroom a rivet. Usually it fractures. Aluminum doesn't, it's not as malleable at that rate of malleation. It just fractures. And also, sometimes the projectile was quite warm, which I found strange.
Well, there's two sources of heat. Let me drop this. The eddy currents that are created in your projectile during the launching process is conveying a significant amount of heat to the projectile. The projectile itself, you can easily measure how many grams it weighs. You've got a rough guess as to how many feet per second it's got. Therefore, it has a significant amount of kinetic energy. You can rate that into joules. When it strikes the brick, a high percentage of those joules of kinetic energy get converted into heat because you're compressing the aluminum at the instant of impact. Some of it gets conveyed into the brick, but I think the aluminum is deflecting a lot more than the brick. So I think so there's at least two procedures by which you're heating the aluminum. Does it get very hot to the touch when you go over there and pick up this pancake off the brick? John, go ahead.
Well, Dick, my test is, I put my finger on it. I could feel it was warm. But what I do is I put it on my cheek, and I can really tell different temperatures much easier that way. And you would not want to leave it against your cheek for, you know, more than a second, because it would become uncomfortable. Not that it would burn you, but it would be uncomfortable.
I think you're saying your hand can continuously hold it if you hold it lightly?
Yes, absolutely.
The rough rule of thumb among the mechanical engineers is that a human hand can come in contact with something at 70 degrees centigrade if it's an extremely light touch. And it's just below the threshold of where you're going to develop a blister or a burn. I hope it's 50 or not 70. It's 70, not 50. I think it's 70 degrees centigrade. I think you can barely hold on to 70 degrees centigrade. So if it was very lightly put into the middle of your palm, could you hold it for a while?
Yes, if I stood that as a mushroom upside down in my palm, yeah, I think I could hold it. But in my fingers, definitely I could hold on to it. No problem with my fingers. But on my cheek, it was uncomfortable.
That sounds like about 50 or 60 degrees centigrade. Now, the aluminum rod you can buy at a Home Depot, I think it's a pretty soft alloy. If you were using aluminum rod of 6061 T6 alloy.
Oh, that's aircraft stuff, right?
You got it. You go to a Reynolds company and you ask for 6061 T6 aluminum rod, and you build your projectiles out of that. You'll get some very different response. Now, I'm not sure about its volumetric resistivity, therefore its efficiency in the railgun itself, but I'm reasonably sure that its penetrating power when it hits the brick will be considerably greater. In other words, it doesn't deform anywhere near as much, and as such, it'll go through the brick a lot better. What's the biggest brick chip you've had to date, John? Go ahead.
Well, a large a red mat brick, which is approximately 8 inches by 3 by 4, roughly, one shot, split one right in half.
Wow. Now, you guys are working with some significant energy here. Wherever you do this testing, I presume you worry about if the projectile missed the target and went flying to whatever is behind it. I presume you're doing it in a fairly innocuous direction. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Well, I have these large granite walls around my house that I built thick. They're 2 feet thick. And that's the back. If it flies over that, I'm going to be in trouble. So we do try to control it, and we have it going to an area. But, you know, all well-played plans, you know, with mice and men and that kind of stuff, things can happen. So I'm trying to be extremely careful with it.
Yeah, it would be interesting also to fire it into something that's known as a target, like the gel, you know, the kind of gel they use when they...
The gel, sure.
Yeah, when they do projectile analysis, bullet analysis, that kind of a gel has a known resistance factor. To find out how far you penetrate into that gel, I think that would give you a very good measurement of muzzle velocity, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I've shot a lot of weapons into that ballistic gel, and it does, by measurement, how deep the penetration is and the angles and things like that. Yep, and it's exactly what happens to human flesh. So when you see that destructive force hit it, like if you were to fire a 30 caliber weapon at it, and you see it split the whole gel in half, you can just imagine what would happen to a human.
Hey, John, WSON.
Yeah, Paul.
Do you think these things are coming at the brick straight on? You know, you think this, you know, I know you don't have any rifling effect, but maybe some of them are hitting the brick with the pointed edge, and some of them are hitting, you know, making a turn in space, or a couple of turns in space. And if that's true, if you could work out a rifling system or something where it would go straight, and then you'd be hitting the brick straight on, you know, all the time. Have you been able to determine that, John? Back to you.
Okay, Paul. Most of the strikes that we did, or most of the firings were at a distance of, I would say, 20 feet. Those seemed to strike on the nose of the projectile. But then we had some ricochets which may have been ones that were tumbling like a like an M16 does, rather the 223 does. And yeah, they could be striking solid front or on their side. We wouldn't know that unless we fired at a paper target, and then we could tell how it's penetrating.
You could put a paper target in front of a brick, and by the way it penetrates the paper, would give you a strong clue as to what the orientation it had at that instant. You could have a couple of pieces of paper at various range, and know real fast what it's doing. Also, I am reasonably sure, Paul, there are ways you can arrange the rail gun so that it acts electronically like rifling. You can put spin on your projectiles. One way to do it would be for each of your rails to be a gentle spiral. That would give it rifling. Over to you, John.
You're probably right. I don't know mechanically that would be a nightmare to build, but we may be able to put some kind of striations on the grooving, or maybe on the projectile itself where it's laying against that land, and that would cause it to rotate. And you don't need much. I mean, that curvature of the rifling, it would only have to vary on an inch. Let's see, maybe 2 millimeters, 3 millimeters from nose to tail, in radial fashion, in a helix.
JBY, question.
JBY, give us your full call and your name, and go right ahead with your question. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
It's K2JBY. Name's John. What are you using on your capacitor bank to fire it? Because this whole thing sounds very similar to a magnetizing machine. I used to work for Dahlquist, and we used to magnetize our own drivers or warpers. And I helped Mr. Dahlquist build a magnetizing fixture that was like 300 turns of number 12 wire. And we bought a magnetizing machine from RSL Labs that put out approximately, I suppose, 20,000 amps at 400 volts. And I was always curious on what kind of switch it used, and it was called an ignitron. And in fact, I had to change it after about 5 years. And what kind of switch are you using to fire this railgun?
Dick, I heard a pretty suggestion of the type of switch that you're using there. That's it can handle that kind of current, no problem. No, we're using a brute force switch. It's a block of aluminum that slams up and makes contact. It's approximately an inch and a quarter square, and it's about 4 inches long. And it does disintegrate after a few shots. So that's what we're using right now. Because we haven't gone anywhere with this, with no refinements. We're blindly poking around with this device and trying to be careful at the same time. Dick, back to you.
KA2JBY, John, that ignitron, how many amperes was it good for? Roughly how expensive do you think it was? Roughly how many volts were you discharging across the ignitron into your coil to do that magnetization? So how many volts were you starting off with? I presume you also had a capacitor bank somewhat like John in Staten Island. KA2JBY, KQRIW.
It was a commercial machine built by a company called, I think, RSL Labs. I think they were in Jersey. I think the machine was someplace between $8,000 and $15,000. We had the low voltage machine. It used to do something between 20 and 30,000 amps at 400 volts. And then we had a high voltage machine that I don't know the specs on, but that thing used to put out over a kilovolt. I mean, the wires, when the charger went through it, would jump around. And that, I think, was also built with number 12 wire. And after three or four shots through it, which was just one big thunk, you couldn't wear a watch near it. You couldn't do anything. I've probably been exposed to about 10,000 of those pulses in my lifetime. So if magnetism's going to hurt anyone, it'll be me.
Answer, do you have any questions?
You said the wires were 12 gauge, and you told us how many turns. 12 gauge, how many turns, what diameter made that magnetic field? John, number two?
The diameter was, I guess, between 8 and 12 inches. And it was 300 times the number 12 because I helped, build the fixture. And we impregnated it with epoxy. And then his father was the machinist, built a iron three-sided cover for the coil. So the magnetism was concentrated right in the center.
Wow. 300 turns at 20 to 30,000 amperes. That is a huge magnetic field. I presume you only had to do that shot once to magnetize the magnet on this loudspeaker. The magnetic material itself, in the old days they may have used Alnico, nowadays they use neodymium iron cobalt, NIC I think they call it. What was the actual magnetic material you were magnetizing? John, number two, go ahead.
All right. It was, I'm trying to remember who made it. I just can't remember. You're talking about Dahlquist back in the late 70s, early 80s. That's when I was head of the Wolfe Department and helped Mr. Dahlquist build the fixture and everything for it. But this machine was amazing on how many pulses it actually put out without failing. And I mean, this thing had coffee can capacitors in it and huge tanks. And it sat there for a few seconds, 30 seconds, let's say, building up the charge, and then one big thunk. And that's it. The ferrite went from totally dead to completely magnetized. I forget what the flux was in the gap of the pulp, between the pulp heats and the magnet.
KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, Glenn also recognized. I got a couple more questions here. This is a beauty. Wow. Dahlquist, I think, is the name of the company. You're making these woofers in this manner, magnetizing them. It builds up in, I think you said, 30 seconds or a minute or so to the roughly 400 volts where it fires the ignitron. Did the ignitron get fired automatically when the voltage hit a critical number, or did you press a button? Over to you, John.
Boy, either way, you could set it by, how many volts you wanted it to fire at, or you could just, let it build up until I forget what the maximum was, and then it would just fire on its own. But it was quite a machine. I don't know if they're still in business or not. It was RSL Labs, and I think they were in Jersey.
That's Romeo Sierra Lima or Romeo Foxtrot Lima?
No, Foxtrot Lima.
And that ignitron is how big physically?
I'm going to say smaller than a 3500Z.
Very good. All right, we got Wesley and Glenn in that order. Wes, you had a question?
I wonder if you would be able to find the time for my question. To handle. I just don't want to interrupt you guys.
Here, I hear you. Glenn, go ahead with your question.
Just a quick comment. I was just listening in the background and it reminded me of something a friend of mine did back in high school, where we had taken a piece of PVC, a very, very narrow one, I think it was like 3/8, and basically wound 12-gauge wire all along the length, basically just winding a coil on the outside, almost like a dowel from one end to the other. And then we used a circuit breaker, like a household 20-amp circuit breaker, and put it across a 12-volt battery and used 10 penny nails and slipped them in the middle of the piece of PVC. And when you close the switch on that circuit breaker, it would just make a momentary, and then it would snap back open again. But it was amazing. We could literally drive nails into the side of a tree. it was pretty impressive, Vic. K3IW, KC2QIQ.
A 10-penny nail you're driving into a tree. Out of curiosity, how far did it go into the tree?
We had to get pretty close. I mean, when it was within, like, let's say, 5 feet or so of that. But it would go in, I would say, probably maybe 3/4 of an inch. I mean, it was enough where you could actually pull it out with your hand. But it was pretty impressive.
Now, once again, describe the magnetic circuit that was doing the accelerating. You got charge capacitors, you could discharging it across a coil, and the coil was accelerating a nail. What did your accelerating mechanism look like? Run that by again, slowly.
Well, the piece of PVC pipe, you know, the plastic pipe was, I don't know, about 3 feet long or so, and basically we just had 12-gauge wire. I don't even know the number of turns. We just very, very tightly wound, you know, 12-gauge wire all the way along the length of this PVC and kind of, like, taped it, because it was insulated wire, and we kind of taped it to stay nice and tight around the PVC tube. And then all we did was we just connected a battery, a 12-volt battery, no capacitors at all, and used a circuit breaker, you know, like a 20-amp household type of circuit breaker, and put it basically the coil was directly in parallel with the battery. Now, the only experiment we had to do in the beginning was that the polarity of plus to minus would determine which end of the tube the nail would fly out. So you had to be a little bit careful with that. But once it was already predicted, we wired the, you know, the plus end to one end of the coil and the back end of the coil back to the circuit breaker and back to the battery. You could just slide a nail in the end, hit the circuit breaker, and the nail would go flying out the other end.
Once again, the PVC pipe was what diameter and what length, and it's a solenoid coil, one-layer solenoid coil. And I've got a guess here as to what was doing the acceleration, and it's a very different process than what John is doing. So roughly how many turns? Was it one layer? How many feet long? And is it one single solenoid coil that you're discharging and accelerating the nail? Over to you, Glenn.
It was just a single layer of 12-gauge wire along approximately 3 feet of PVC tube. And we just kind of wound it very, very tight. It was insulated 12-gauge wire and wound it in a single layer all the way down from one end to the end. So we had one wire at one end of the tube, one wire down at the other end of the tube. And then we just brought the two wires back to the battery. And then what we used was the shorting mechanism across the battery. It was just like a household circuit breaker, you know, a 20-amp circuit breaker. So when you made the closure, basically that's how you'd fire the nail. And we just put put a 10-penny nail in the middle of, I think it was 3/8 diameter. It's a very, very thin diameter PVC pipe.
Question? Yeah. Go ahead, John. I've got a guess as to what's going on. Without that circuit breaker, you wouldn't get the effect you think you're going to get. Over to you, John.
Answer, Glenn. Was it aluminum nails or steel nails?
10-penny steel nails. Actually, where we got the idea from was a Mother Earth magazine. And actually, we built it exactly to their instructions, and it worked.
Guess what would happen if you closed the circuit the way John is closing the circuit, and you didn't have the circuit breaker? What do you think would happen, Glenn?
It might just freeze the nail in place, I would think.
The nail, I think, would bounce back and forth. What's really happened is you were making a axial magnetic field, which is very different than the magnetic field John number one is making. That nail wanted to move itself toward the center of the magnetic field where the magnetic field was strongest. Because your PVC pipe is roughly 3 feet long, the strongest magnetic field was at the 1.5-foot point. So if you were connecting the current and accelerating the nail between the end and the 3.5-foot point, and then you disconnect the current, that's what your circuit breaker did, now whatever acceleration you built up didn't become deceleration for the next 1.5 feet. You getting the picture on that? That's what I think was happening, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're right about that, Dick, because I never really analyzed it very, very much, but as a matter of fact, they were very specific about the type of circuit breaker to use. You know, use the 20-amp, and we had most of the stuff just lying around. So it was kind of interesting that we just tried it, and it was pretty impressive that, you know, how well it did work.
Did you have to, your PVC tubing, I think you said 3/8-inch diameter, the thin stuff, what mechanically held that down? Because you do have action and reaction here. While you're accelerating the nail forward, the PVC tubing and its coil wants to go backwards. So what was that connected to? Over to you, Glenn.
Handheld.
Wow. Did the guy hand-holding it to feel some thrust, so to speak?
Not too much. It was pretty much momentary, Dick. It was you know, pretty light, but it was funny. It was impressive. You know, there again, I don't think it was anywhere near as impressive as what John is doing over there. But, you know, as I said, it was just basically, I think the battery that we were using, too, was just like one of the small motorcycle batteries, which is, you know, the circuit breaker and the wire on the tube. And I said, the only thing you had to be careful of in the beginning was which way you wired that coil, because if you wound it in one direction, the nail would go out at one end, and if you did it the other way, it would come out the other end. So it was definitely polarity sensitive.
Yeah, there I'm having problems. So you're telling me if you took the battery and reversed the two leads, even though you're putting the nail into the end that's closest to your body, and you want it to fly out the far end, you're saying you put the nail on the near end, and instead of entering, it would exit at that near end and have almost no velocity? Is that what you're saying with reverse polarity?
Yeah, pretty much. It would just kind of bounce out the other side.
You said bounce out the other side. Do you mean bounce out the side it came in on? I presume you put in the nail so that the head of the nail is just barely inside of the PVC tubing, and then you close the circuit. Would the head of the nail come back out toward you if you had the reverse polarity?
Yeah, that's pretty much how it worked. So in other words, you had to know which direction you had the polarity. And I think it also depended on how you wound the coil. So in other words, depending on the direction that you wound the coil, and we taped it down, and then in other words, you had a wire connected to the end, one end of the coil down at one end of this piece of PVC tubing, and one down at the other end. So you had the two wires coming out, and you had to watch the polarity on it when you put it in, and you could just slide the nail in. And depending on which way the polarity was, would determine which way the nail went.
So in other words, you guys did intentionally reverse the polarity, or at first you made it wrong, and it came out the wrong end. I'm having a lot of trouble understanding why the nail would be magnetic field polarity sensitive. That's a tough one. Over to you, Glenn.
As I said, Dick, it's not something I ever analyzed, but it was just interesting that it did work, and it was amazing. But yeah, definitely the polarity. Well, they tell you actually when you were building this thing, it was in Mother Earth magazine. This is going back, I guess, in the late 70s, and you know, they would show you how to wind it around you know, a piece of PVC pipe, put the you know, put the nail in, and then they would tell you, like, when you make the connection, you know, put you know, when you're making the connection, put the nail in, and just verify which end it comes out on, and in this way you'll know you have the correct polarity.
N2NNU.
Well, there are all kinds of safety requirements on this thing. Did they give you lots of warning on this Mother Earth article?
No, because I don't think it was as powerful as, you know, it's nothing like what John is doing. Let's put it that way.
N2NNU, K2RIW. Go ahead, Alex. Have you ever built a nail gun accelerator?
No, Dick, sorry. But I'm requesting words with Glenn after the net. I need to ask him something that I don't want to bother everybody else. So, Glenn, if you have any time after the net, 2 minutes only, or at least 1 minute of your time, please. Let's do an interview.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll see if the repeater's still on. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a problem. The repeater does get turned off at midnight. So maybe Alex is going to have to ask his question now, because when we end the net, the repeater gets thoroughly turned off. N2NNU, K2RIW.
Hey, Glenn. Thank you, Dick. Glenn, do you have a phone number where I can call you better? I would like to talk to you in private, over.
No, unfortunately, I can't right now, Alex. And the other problem is I'm going to be in China, so I'm kind of packing right now, and I'll be in China for probably the next till the end of June. So, I mean, my time is kind of limited right now. KC2QIQ.
You guys buy that many light-emitting diodes and power supplies that you're going to be spending some time in Shenzhen? And by the way, hey, Glenn, your timing could be better. You're going to the hottest part of the world during the hottest time of the year. A buddy of mine from Texas who really knows heat, you know, Ken, WA5DJB, he's had some 105-degree days that go on for weeks on end in Dallas area. You better You better bring some air conditioning clothing with you. Over to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
That's a dick. Rub it in. No, this one actually was not very well planned, in my opinion, but I guess it's kind of a necessity. And so we've got a couple of product releases going on, a lot of high-profile things going on for this release, and a lot of new products all going out at once. So you can say I've been volunteered, if you know what I mean. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Has anyone given you any warning as to what kind of heat you're about to go into?
Well, from what I understand, it's in the 90s over there. It's humid, and, it's going to be interesting.
You better bring your very winter-weight clothing. I know that Wes has got a question, so go ahead, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. I don't know if John would allow me to change the subject, just getting got kind of frustrated. Questions about magnetostatics. We've been discussing electrostatics for quite a time, and your explanation about magnetostatics and the phenomena attached to that. Back to you.
I've heard the word magnetic statics.
Magnetostatics, M-A-G-N-E-T-O-S-T-A-T-I-T-S.
Okay, I've heard the word. Now I'm waiting for the question.
Yeah, could you refer something about magnetostatics, what it is, what are the properties, I mean, what it's really in regards to. Enter here.
You said, could I explain what is magnetostatic? You're not going to like this. The answer is no. I think I have no knowledge on what you're talking about.
How about Glenn?
You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that's a word, Dick. I'm sure that it is, but it's not one that I'm familiar with. Back to the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
How about John?
Magnetostatics?
Yes.
Don't know a thing about it.
And now that we've got the right pronunciation, have you ever had some familiarity with this one, Glenn? You got it, Glenn?
I think it might be something that I'm familiar with, but I'm not really sure. I've never heard the term used that way. I mean, the static analysis of magnetic fields, it could possibly be that, but I'm not sure that that's what he means. You know, I mean, there's looking at static field measurements, that's, you know, it's part of like a statics and dynamics course of magnetic materials. But is that what you're looking for, Wesley? I don't know.
N2XJN. It's a part of electromagnetism. Electrostatics, magnetostatics, electrodynamics, electrical network. All of this is assigned to electromagnetism. Magnetostatic is the study of magnetic fields. I'm reading right now. In system where the currents are steady, not changing with time. It is the magnetic analog of electrostatics, where the charges are stationary. The magnetization need not to be static. The equation of the magnetostatics can be used to predict fast magnetic switching events that occur on the time scales of nanoseconds or less. Magnetostatics is even a good approximation when the currents are not static, and as long as the currents do not alterate rapidly. Magnetostatics is widely used in applications of micromagnetics, such models of recording devices and whatsoever. And then I have explanation of the Maxwell equation assigned to that. I'm reading from Wikipedia right now. Dick?
Slightly related to this, Glenn, maybe you know something I don't. At the atomic level, what really makes the magnetic field? Is it the way all the electron orbits get lined up in a ferromagnetic material? Is it something to do with the protons? What really, at the atomic level, generates a magnetic field? If you happen to know. I don't feel comfortable with that one. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, at the quantum level, I'm not even sure that a magnetic field really exists. You know, there's charge. I mean, everything is in terms of charge. EV, electron volts. When we talk about magnetic fields, generally, we're talking about much larger structures. So I'm not sure that a singular charge of, at the molecular level constitutes magnetic field. There again, it's a limit of my knowledge as well, Dick. Back to your K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I think we have not much to say about it, so I would like to go to another subject.
Yeah, Alex wants to say something. N2NNU, I bet you he's worked with this. K2RIW, go ahead, Alex.
I did not hear the entire question, but I think I have an answer for it. Can you repeat the question, please?
Alex, we have a limited time. I was giving only 15 minutes. I would like to go with more, but it's about magnetostatics, M-A-G-N-E-T-O-S-T-A-T-I-C-S, or John is pronouncing this magnetostatics.
I think Alex was referring to Dick's question.
Yeah, do you know at the atomic level what goes on to make a magnetic field? Over to you, Alex.
Yes, I know. It's the electron spin phase correlation. That's all that is there.
Okay, now, is it the electron spinning on its own center of mass, or is it the orbit of the electron around the nucleus? Which spin are we speaking of here? Over to you, Alex.
Orbit, same orbital. Electrons are in phase and in phase spinning in the orbit and around them themselves. So it's a total synchronization between the electrons. Go ahead.
Okay, so it sounds like some of the magnetic field is coming from the spin of the electron, some of it's coming by the orbit. I presume both of them have the same axis of rotation when a magnetic field is being formed. Are the protons in the nucleus contributing to that? Is any of the magnetic field coming from the nucleus, or is it all electron action? N2NNU, K2LIW.
It's all electrons. Protons do not contribute here, but the only contribution of them, it is the spacing between the electrons, between the protons. That means that the protons have to be of the same matter. You will not have a magnetic material constructed of multiple materials like alloys, which will not be compatible with the electron spin on the same orbital.
Now, it's well known that certain materials are not easy to magnetize, but yet I still have electrons in orbit. I have electrons that I can make spin. What's wrong with the materials that will not accept magnetization? Why can't I spin those electrons synchronously with their orbitals? N2NNU, K2RIW.
Orbits are not at the same position in respect to the protons. Some orbits are this distance, other orbits are another distance. We're speaking about the same level of orbits. So if the orbits are not in the same at the same distance of the proton, you will have a hard time to magnetize it.
If I take a ferromagnetic material that has electrons in multiple orbit, let me call them altitudes, radius, are all of the electrons in each of the radiuses all contributing, or is it only the valence electrons that are contributing to the magnetic field? N2NNU, K2RIW.
That's when I can answer, Dick. KC2QIQ, but over to Alex.
I guess the answer will be the same, Glenn. Why don't you go ahead, but my answer will be that you have to have the same orbital distance between the electrons and the protons, meaning that the size of the entire atom must be more or less similar. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, see, Dick, this is where in chemistry and basically atomic physics come together when the rubber starts hitting the road. When we're talking about things at the atomic level, that's why where you asked me about, like, let's say an atom of hydrogen, per se, where you have the two electrons, and you basically, an atomic mass of two. At that point in case, we're talking about electron charge, or E. And then, of course, charge has to be associated to other molecules. So similar charge between valence electrons. So now when we start getting into a compound of material like iron, what's happening is the electrons can be associated in such a way that basically currents can flow within the material. And in other words, you actually have an internal current, and that's what creates the magnetic field, thus the beginning of magnetism and magnets. So you can actually align a series or domains of electrons within a material, but here again, that's multiple atoms working together in a material, such as iron, that will allow those domains to exist, and then the magnetic field is available. But when you start getting down to a singular atomic structure, such as an atom, does magnetism exist? I don't hold this as, as like a proof or positive or anything, but I would probably suggest it doesn't. KC2QIQ.
Any idea what's so magic about neodymium that when it's combined into the right compound is able to make such an extremely strong steady-state magnetic field? What's magic about the neodymium that allows it to happen, Glenn?
It's a material that's magnetic in nature, and it has many, many domains, so such that its alignment chemically allows its valence electrons to create domains that have circulating currents within that material, so that if you measure across the material on the top end, you'll basically measure zero voltage across the material, but within the material, at the molecular level, there are circular domains of current flow within that basically wind up with a net result, almost like having a perfect conductor, where there's no voltage across the inductor, but currents constantly flowing that create a magnetic field. So it's the alignment of those valence electrons in domains within that material that all line up in the same direction, thus giving the magnet a very, very strong polarization in one direction. So you have a definitely defined north and south pole across the total material. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
What's going on with the thermodynamics? When you have a movement of the electrons, you have a friction. You have a temperature, calorimetry.
Maybe that was developed. Wes is asking is, why is there a so-called Curie temperature? In other words, as I raise the temperature of a magnet above some critical number, usually it'll lose magnetic field. I guess what's happening is that the shaking of the molecules of the atoms that are in a lattice form becomes so violent that the alignment they used to have gets lost. Is that approximately what happens from your experience, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Absolutely, Dick. Those domains of basically electromagnetic force are being disturbed by temperature. In other words, temperature has effects on material that will distort them. And what's happening there is that you've reached a temperature at which the domains are no longer in proper alignment and the magnetic field can fall apart. And in other materials, such as just plain ferrite, where you're trying to make a transformer, the fields will be disturbed enough such that you can't have a low loss magnetic field in proper alignment anymore. So this material saturates very, very quickly. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to be trying to reword the question. When you have the internal current flowing through the domains, then we have a temperature. Why then the magnet is cold?
hold on now, just because current is flowing doesn't mean you've got temperature being generated.
Huh? What about the loss of conservation energy?
All the molecules in the air in the room with you are continuously colliding with each other, but every one of those bounces is perfect and no thermal heat is generated.
We have a current or we don't have a current between the domains. It's not inside the atom when we have a perfect vacuum.
Maybe Glenn is saying that in the domain, the current that's flowing is of a kind of current similar to superconductivity. No voltage drop, no power dissipated. That's a guess on my part. What do you say, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Yeah, I don't want to confuse the word superconductivity, but one of similar principles within a magnet is that it is a potential state. In other words, that domain of electrons that are assembled at the molecular level. In other words, basically they're aligned in such a direction that there's an internal sharing of current that's in perfect balance. So what's happening is that there's no kinetic loss. It's in a potential state, and that's why you don't measure a voltage across the material. It's all within domains that are aligned together. So it's an internal current flow, but because it's not across a resistance, per se, or a conductor, that basically the magnetic field is maintained. So this is one of those ones where you have a discontinuity with Ohm's law. In other words, where normally you would have, in the power equations, E, I, and R, there is no R component and no voltage component, just a current component. KC2QIQ.
And happened. You don't talk about the electron within the atom, but you're talking about the domain. That means the groups of an atom. Now, when you have a group turner of the atom, and you say that the current flows, then you have a colorimetry effect. Therefore, you've got to have a temperature. And to XGN.
Now, maybe you want to add to that one, Glenn.
I think I would just be repeating myself, Dick. I think when I say Ohm's law, that there's no... in other words, when you have Ohm's law or resistance loss and kinetic loss, you're generally suggesting that there's a voltage source, a resistance, and a current flow. You know, the typical power triangle, so to speak. In a domain, what's happening is that you have a singularity. What's happening is that there's no apparent voltage on the outside. There is no resistance, just an apparent current due to the domain of aligned atomic items that are sharing electrons in such a way that appears to be a continuous loop of current. So there's no power loss in that particular application. KC2QIQ.
I'm going to guess that the domain consists of multiple atoms and maybe even multiple molecules of materials, neodymium, iron, and cobalt, we'll say. So there are multiple atoms, multiple molecules grouped together in some kind of a way that we call a domain. Within that domain, the valence electrons, I am guessing, are being shared in such a way that they follow particular paths of their orbits, particular spins of the electrons, alignment of the spins and alignment of the orbits of those valence electrons within that domain of multiple atoms. I mean, the electrons that go around a nucleus of a hydrogen atom, that electron is a charge, it's in motion, but he's not dissipating any energy. By the same token, I'm guessing the electrons move in this magic way in the domain, which again are a little bit like that electron around the nucleus of a atom. They're moving in a very ordered way, but not dissipating energy. Is that close, Glenn? KC2QIQ? K2RIW, a bunch of guesses?
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. I mean, there's better ways of me explaining it, it requires a certain level of chemistry and a little bit of physics, but it's not too hard. You can find that explanation by studying material iron in a good chemistry book. I would imagine certain, good high school chemistry books and some very, very entry-level chemistry and you know, just study iron and the magnetic properties. It's explained there very, very well. Far better than I can do just simply here tonight on the TechNet. KC2 QIQ.
Yeah, well, we have 2 minutes left. The thing is that I remember when Dick said, inside an atom we have a perfect vacuum, that's why we have a continuous motion of the electrons. Okay, so what the electron has the energy to cruise around the nuclei. Okay, it's because, you know, like explaining the gas. But then, when the electron gets out of the atom, goes to the other atom, there's no perfect vacuum there. At that point, we kind of have to have a losses. So there might be an explanation, but not this one. And to exist.
We're going to be cut off in about 30 seconds. This was TechNet number 1401 of the series that began in September of 1982, 29 and a half years ago. See you guys next week. But in between the electrons and the nucleus of every single atom is tremendous amounts of empty space. If you built a atom the size of a football stadium, something the size of an apple in the middle of the stadium would be the nucleus, and the electrons would be going around the outside of the stadium. Tremendous amounts of empty space in every single atom. So when we start grouping atoms together, and those electrons are deciding to hop from one nucleus to the next nucleus because there's a compound there, it doesn't mean they have to be dissipating energy. These things are moving, only being controlled by the local charges, and they're not colliding with each other. There is no, they're not sliding on a piece of...